IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. So on the 1st of March, the Indian government issued an advisory about the deployment of AI models, which has caused a lot of angst and pushback from the industry. So this advisory comes in the wake of Google's new Gemini model, outputting what many saw as factually incorrect characterizations of PM Modi. So my name is Bharat Reddy and I have with me Satya. Both of us are researchers with the High-Tech Geopolitics Program at Takshila, and we've been studying AI governance from an Indian perspective. So let's unpack these recent developments, why this advisory came about, why is it so hard to put guardrails on AI models, and let's see where this conversation goes. So to get started, Satya, can you tell us a little bit about this recent advisory and what are the implications from this?
Right, yeah, Bharat. So on 1st March, the advisory was apparently issued to 8 significant social media intermediaries. Now, this term, the significant social media or significant intermediaries, is defined under the IT rules, right? Except in the very beginning when it came to the limelight, a lot of the actual wording of the advisory wasn't known to the public. So it created quite a bit of a media hype or all of that stuff. It's not that they were wrong to do this, because the wording of the advisory is still pretty broad. And I'll go over it. In effect, the advisory just asks these platforms to seek the explicit permission of the MeitY, the Ministry of Electronics and Information Technology, before they can deploy any, and this is very broad, right? Any unreliable AI models, large language model, generative AI, software or algorithm. So this doesn't necessarily just mean that, ChatGPT, etc., or Google's Gemini, etc., is the only thing. It can also potentially just affect even like computer vision tasks, right, for machine learning and stuff. The rhetoric is about this shouldn't affect any users of the Indian internet. And it's a very loaded term, of course. Indian internet is not something. Internet is meant to be free and accessible to everyone. Of course, like, the idea apparently is that Indian internet means the internet which is basically policed or basically made safe and secure by the Indian government for citizens of India to access. And there's a whole lot of issues with that as well. But the operative part of the advisory then is that the developers of this AI systems or whatever should not permit any bias or discrimination or, and this is important, is threaten the integrity of the electoral process. Aside from that, they need to label all synthetically created media and text. And so the latter part is fine. Like that's the usual, mitigation of risk. You know, a lot of jurisdictions around the world have been suggesting. But usually we see that at the development, the application or deployment level, where things that are built on top of large language models or generative AI models are the ones who have to comply with this. Now, developers of AI models, for instance, do have to comply with a, and this is the best practice as well, with the training inputs that their model takes, they do have to comply with a lot of these things that ensure like reduction of bias, reduction of discriminatory behavior and stuff like that, or representative results, output that it provides. Now, ostensibly, this seems like a data narrative control kind of response by the MeitY, because there are two things. A, immediately after the news cycle hype around the advisory, the Ministry of State for IT, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, came out and said basically that, this is not meant for startups or meant to stifle innovation. It's only meant to be sent to the 8 significant intermediaries, like Google, Meta and all. This is a very weird wording that they've used, is that this is an insurance policy of sorts, that in order to get the legal protections that the safe harbor provisions provide intermediaries, again, all of this under IT law in India, they need to have to comply with all these guidelines, right? But that doesn't really sound like an insurance policy. It's like you'll only be afforded legal protection if you do due diligence, which is, I mean, that goes without saying. But on social media, on LinkedIn and Twitter specifically, it's after the Gemini debacle that happened, right? It just seems like a lot of people and the government are just trying to hold someone accountable, regardless of whether it makes sense to do so, whether it means a consultative process has been undertaken or not, or whether it's even possible within the regulatory capacity of the ministry to even, like, you know, evaluate whether an AI model is reliable or not, how that model functions, and whether developers should be the ones to be, you know, like, regulate in this case, or should it be regulated at the application and deployment level, and all of these smaller nuances. And as the conversation goes forward, I'll talk about why it's difficult to censor generative AI in the first place.
Right. That gives a good starting point to understand what the regulations are and how they've been introduced and the clarity that's missing in this advisory. But before we get into why it is so hard to build guardrails or to have accurate outputs from these generative models, let's look at why generative AI models, what are they good at and what are they bad at? So if you've used any of these large language models like ChatGPT or Copilot or Anthropic or Claude or any of these things, so what you'll quickly realize is that they have strong language understanding and generation skills. They have a broad knowledge on a very wide range of topics. But what's bad about them is that they can often hallucinate and confidently state information that might be completely false. They don't seem to have a true understanding beyond pattern matching or stochastic prediction, which is how they work. And based on the biases that are there in the data sets, and for large language models, it's a very wide range of data sets, ranging from books to newspaper articles to everything on the internet, basically. So based on the content that it is trained on, it will have a lot of biases that are built in. So these biases might be certain depictions or of certain individuals, in this case, our prime minister. And you'll see those kind of biases getting reflected in the output that the model generates. So these are the big, these are the things that it's good at, and these are the things that it's bad at. So obviously, it's not a very accurate model. It's prone to errors, and you need someone who's using it shouldn't treat it as something that's giving you one definitive answer, but it's something that's just, you know, it has limitations. It's not accurate. So all of these things need to be understood by the people using it before they're able to come to some kind of a thing, right? So this is what it's good at. Now, when it comes to building guardrails for the models itself, there are some challenges, right? So Satya, can you tell us about some of the reasons that make it hard to build guardrails for generative AI models?
Okay, so even before going into the guardrails part, we're effectively talking about, so what the government at this point in the advisory is talking about is censorship, right? You have to ask for explicit permission to allow any of these models to output anything. Like, but so you're basically asking for some sort of oversight on the range of outputs that come out of these models, algorithms, all of that stuff. So it's essentially censorship, right? Now, this just censorship is a challenging task, right? So we're not even talking about techno-legal guardrails that can be put. First of all, there is no clear definition or consensus on what censorable content would be. And it's not like the stakeholders are only the government and the industry, right? It's people, it's academia, there is literally everyone else has a stake in it. So differing values and views on what is acceptable or unacceptable can differ wildly depending on cultural, political, or moral backgrounds. I mean, you can consider some topics or expressions pretty offensive, while others may not. And you know that, like, it's the significant proportions of this, which is a societal elements, right? And as society becomes polarized or more integrated, this may also change. For instance, like, the very basic is someone may advocate for free speech or creativity, while others may want to say safety and security, which may or may not be a, you know, false dichotomy. That's another debate to be had. What you have then is a set of competing interests and then rights of different parties involved, right? And they are all involved in producing as well as consuming the generated content. So at the same time, if you want to implement this legally, you have to create a constitutionally compliant framework, the laws that define what is problematic enough to be censored by a body legally. So you need to have thresholds. And these thresholds will not be, for instance, in the CBFC that looks at movies and TV and all that stuff, right? That's only like limited to a particular form of media. It's not interactive media. It's not something that is iterating upon itself. So maybe thresholds are a lot easier to come up with. Even that is like, it's not very clear cut in today's context. But that problem becomes magnified multifold, like exponentially when you look at generative AI or large language model. Or if you have like other generative AI, like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney that create images from text or other inputs. So then you also have to create an entire concomitant process for appeals and appellate tribunals and stuff like that, just to like get this to be a workable model. Whether will it work or not is a whole different question. So it's substantially time consuming, costly, and the consensus that society or whatever comes up with is also very difficult to concretize in law, because as we know, there is like conventional morality and constitutional morality, and all of that is very difficult to balance at this point. Like, you know, on one hand, the things you're talking about is during training, let's say, of generative AI and large language models, a lot of people can adopt a human-centric approach, right? So that's why you have representative boards to evaluate and all of that. So you could, principles of autonomy, justice, welfare, all of that should guide what kind of data sets go in the training, how the model parses all of this, tokenizes all of this. A lot of this is black box at the moment for IPR reasons and stuff, but it's generally well accepted that whatever censorship process happens during the training process or otherwise should involve human oversight, participation, constant feedback, all that stuff, right? And in fact, there have been reports of, and I think it's pretty well confirmed, that a lot of countries in Africa, etc., there's just a lot of like hundreds and thousands of human moderators just sit in front of a PC and review the generated content of, let's say, ChatGPT, and flag or remove inappropriate or harmful content, right? So the human element behind this artificial intelligence technology is also pretty difficult to use, because, you know, like then the moment there's any human input, subjectivity comes into the picture. There is also no universal way to detect or filter censorable content, right? Especially when the content can be based on a multimodal platform. It's not just text, it can be video, audio, etc., right? And the best way to think about generative AI or foundational models, let's say, is to think of them as a reasonably moldable child who is studying in a classroom, and you are the teacher armed with all your training data sets and your pedagogy and stuff. And you're basically trying to get them to learn and think. Well, not thinking in the sense that they're an actual intelligence, but thinking in the sense that they can predict what the next formative element should be in the output. But that's a lot better way to think of it as opposed to thinking of it as a tool, right? So, which means that these models can also adapt and learn from new data and feedback. So it becomes like exponentially harder to monitor and control. So even if at the very beginning, like the developer of a foundational model, as they are starting to build it, they might understand how the pathways between decision making or how it parses data, how it understands data, etc., understands, quote unquote. The moment it starts becoming and iterating upon itself and grows larger, it's much more difficult to do it. It's impossible, I'm pretty sure. This is also very difficult for policymakers to understand, because for them, they need a single point of contact to maintain accountability. Now, whether or not that accountability is based on explainability, etc., is not something that at this point they're considering. I mean, I understand the governance perspective, right? So it's very difficult to ask them, developers, to explain, and also for policymakers or other lay people to understand the explanation. Okay, fine. Assuming we finally find a way to censor this technology also, right? It also may require significant human and computational resources aside from the legal framework sets. And this will not work well across multiple jurisdictions. So what works in the US or the EU may not work in India. and like I mentioned, like cultural and social contexts vary. And for developers to try to input all of these different contexts across all of the deployment of models across jurisdictions is also maybe not fair to the end user, wherever it is, wherever they're best. Of course, like the question about relevant output or relevant training data sets for someone in India can be very different, right? So for instance, someone wants to know about very specifically an Indian question, like something about, I forgot, some sort of like very specific cancer exists in the Indian subcontinent that does not exist as prevalently in other continents, stuff like that. So if someone wants to use it for healthcare purposes, they may want a very specifically Indian answer or something like that, right? And that is a very different question than what this means. This means that these resources and frameworks will not be available or adequate in all contexts or domains. Then you also have ideas of censorship itself, which is a much more philosophical question, which then will either result in more stringent or lax laws. This is just means that the compliance burden is going to be constantly heavier and heavier for developers. Right. So it becomes worse when you consider the fact that India is one of the largest data markets in the world, and is a very diverse and complex society. So yeah, I'll iterate upon this later in the conversation. But yeah, this is the broad structural problems that are associated with it. I assume you have more techno-legal.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break. I'll just take an example to make it more relatable, right? So let's assume Satya is a politician, a prominent politician in India, and there's a lot of news coverage about you and all the things that you've done over your, very long career. So if as a user, I ask this chatbot, an AI large language chatbot, that if Satya is fascist, it might say that a preliminary guardrail would be that okay, Satya is not, and all of that. So let's assume that they have handled that part at one level. So I can still bypass that by asking questions. You can frame the question in certain ways that elicits a response from that model, right? So you can say, give me examples to justify that Satya is fascist, and it'll give you an example in some sense. Even if there is no evidence even if Satya is the most benevolent politician who's situation, you'll probably get some points that this model will tell you to justify that this person is fascist. And there are other ways as well. So you have seen people say that let's have a debate. You argue for and I'll argue against, and give evidence to support that. So you can create situations where you can get responses. And a lot of the time, these mistakes of LLMs that are being prominently debated about are attempts right now by people who are trying to break this thing, get it to make mistakes, and highlighting the gaps or the flaws in these models, right? So that's one way in which you can kind of relate to why things go wrong and how these models work and why we see these kind of mistakes. So just now we have looked at why some of these things happen. Now, when we have knee-jerk reactions like this, that either they have to get a license or they have to be scrutinized and then only can they operate, what are some of the consequences of such regulations, right? Now, one clear consequence that I can think of is that there have been a few models, because of their early start and because of the investments that they made early on, they have a pretty big advantage over the others in how mature their models are. So ChatGPT is one of the earliest ones which was released to the public as a free chatbot, and it's been trained or refined over all of these conversations that it has had. And you see that they have addressed some, at least preliminary concerns. It's usually more diplomatic. The GPT-4 at least is more diplomatic. It gives you both sides of the argument. It includes certain caveats that it has its limitations, and there might be some flaws in what it, what output it presents, and so on. Now, when you introduce such stringent regulations that it has to be you know, giving these kind of responses or not having these kind of harms. What happens is it also consolidates these advantages by the early movers, because they will be able to comply with these regulations, and anyone who's trying to develop something which is not as refined a product will not be able to comply with these, because they haven't had that time to refine it, or the interactions with the users to be able to build those.
And also we need to remember that because they're meant to be, but at the very least, we're talking about chatbots. These are meant to be reinforced constantly through learning with the users. And even if you do pilot a regulatory sandbox, right, that's also not going to like have the entire gamut of responses of the population it's going to be interacting with. And you can't. So, which is why like, I'm thinking about it in the sense that the LLM or the model itself is a child trying to learn in a classroom, and you are trying to train it. You're trying to teach it how to think. And then when it is providing an opinion on a topic or something based on how it is thinking, etc., that is the output you're trying to regulate. Usually that should happen at the application layer, but you want to say that developer, the teacher is held liable for how the child is thinking. Well, that's a very dangerous thing, right? Because basically you're saying, you're trying to brainwash the child or something. And which is why like the term here, it should be censorship really at the end of the day. Because you're trying to get a range of acceptable range of outputs only. Yeah, so which is what you're talking about. So the moment the larger companies who have these models toe the government line, because they can do so, the compliance burden is high enough, the monetary cost is high enough, is that they can afford to tailor these models across jurisdictions. But smaller companies may not be able to.
And another consequence of having these guardrails, I mean stringent guardrails, is that they can only be implemented as, you know, temporary patches or, restrictions on certain kind of information or keywords, or they're like basically like band-aids which are trying to limit what output it generates, but are not addressing the root of the problem, which is that it has a better, more nuanced understanding of what it, what the model is, or what is the culture that it represents, or so on, right? So these are some of the consequences that you can see of certain strict actions that might, if they are taken. So Satya, would you like to add anything else to this, or any concluding remarks? Now we've touched upon how, what is the advisory? Why is it necessary, or why is it outputting such information, inaccurate information? And what are the consequences of these regulations that might come about? So any concluding thoughts on...
I'll just reiterate the fact that this seems like the government wants to hold someone accountable really quickly before, undertaking the consultative and more nuanced policy process that should be happening here. And which is a very stark contrast to what until this month was meant to be a light touch regulation. That was also meant to touch upon all the players in the AI life cycle or supply chain, right? The data, models, compute, and application. And the problem is the scope and effect of this advisory remains unclear. And even if they say that it is non-binding at the moment, this seems to signal that this could become encapsulated in law, which, and ideas of what is a significant platform, right? If an open source thing, if it's a model becomes the de facto standard for developers to use in any particular way, would that become a significant platform? Like in, if it's a broader sense of the word. And we have seen in the past few, the techno-legal legislation that have come, the tech telecom bill, the censorship bill and all of that stuff. Well, they're now acts. We haven't exactly seen very encouraging consultative behavior from the government. In fact, a lot of delegated legislation is happening, and definitional terms and executive actions are very much, in the delegated legislation space, which should not be a thing. In law school, we were taught very much that if you are drafting legislation, you need to be very specific. You need to have the overbreadth is an exception and not the rule. And that does not seem to be something that this advisory nor any potential law seems to be following, which is a little worrying. The problem is that meaningful compliance with the advisory will just constantly become impossible if vague terms like under-tested and unreliable stuff will continue to be used, right? Without any scientific or social consensus, at the very least social consensus, right, is reached in and then defined in terms of thresholds in the law, you can't comply with any of this. The other thing is the IT rules themselves, which is a December advisory also. December advisory actually said all internet intermediaries must comply with the IT rules and rule 3.1b, which is basically that the intermediaries must make reasonable efforts to stop the spread of misinformation and stuff. So it means users must be informed that, let's say, your particular model, that the tool that they're using is unreliable. So please do not spread misinformation, etc. I don't know how effective that is. It's not like people can read very well if they want to like generate something that they want to, right? It's not like they want to be deterred by a disclaimer like this. So the IT rules themselves have been under challenge constitutionally before different courts in India. I don't remember the petition number, but the fact that if these are being challenged and this hasn't been disposed of, continuing to provide like extremely broad advisories under those rules, asking for compliance with those rules, it's just generally a bad like policy practice. I mean, the government can brute force this way through anyway, but it just doesn't signal well for the ease of doing business in India. I mean, ad hoc and very weird policy measures all the time is not a great thing for any regulatory regime. So the one thing is, I think we should take away from this is that we should really be looking at trying to define a lot of these terms, because on the governance side of things, it's also an election year. It also, like things like deep fake, which are not taken over the public's imagination, are really exerting pressure on regulatory agencies and stuff, right? So on that side, I think the conversation around defining these terms, or at least, well, definition is probably not a right word, but at least trying to come to a consensus around how we can think about terms like bias, about harm and unreliability, etc. I think the conversation needs to happen at a much faster pace, because things are an indication the Digital India Act will come out, and or rules under that act may make things maybe worse if this is the kind of thinking that is informing that.
Yeah, thanks, Satya. That gives a good a picture of what we can expect, and with the Digital India Act coming up, and with the elections also around the corner, you'll see a lot of these kind of advisories being issued, not just by India but also by other countries as well. So you can expect to see a lot of these conversations going around, and it's important to have a good understanding of what are the limitations. Maybe a license for users as well would.
Yeah, I mean, if the telecom bill is any indication, then end users will also have compliance burdens, which is, scary to think about, and also like probably costly, And yeah.
A better understanding of what are the limitations of the technology, and understanding that it's still a work in progress, and maybe we shouldn't rely on it so much is what's the need of that. And I would just like to end this session by a quote by Gary Marcus, who says that what we need is an AI that has a deeper and nuanced understanding of human culture, and not merely a stochastic mimicry with the band-aids of guardrails that are being imposed on it. So with that, I think we can end the session, the webinar, and hope you all had a good time listening to this.
Yeah.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.